Skeptic's Guide to Conspiracy, a bi-weekly podcast dedicated to the examination of conspiracy theory, conspiracy fact, and those who promote these theories. I will be your host, Mike Bowler, as I examine a conspiracy theory, applying critical thinking and skepticism to better understand and seek out the truth behind conspiracy theories. And this episode is going to be a listener-inspired show. This is my one-year anniversary for doing this podcast, so I thought I would do something that the listeners have shown a pretty strong interest in. And I'm going to be doing the, basically, rock and roll conspiracies. This is going to involve various bands, not necessarily conspiracies, but just questions that have come up. And then, of course, then there's some pretty hardcore conspiracies involving rock and roll. So I'm going to start first with not necessarily a conspiracy per se, but certainly has raised questions. That involves the band Lynyrd Skynyrd. Now, if you're familiar, this is an American rock and roll band who was very fairly popular in the 70s and had kind of defined the Southern rock genre, though they did not like the idea of calling Southern rock. They thought they were more of a progressive rock band, but needless to say, growing up in the 70s, some fairly poignant songs like Free Bird and some of my favorites besides Free Bird, Sweet Home Alabama, Tuesday's Gone. And they did a mix of new songs plus remakes of old songs like Tea for Texas. There was an old Woody Guthrie song. But on October 20th, about 3 days after the release of their album Street Survivors, and 5 shows into their most successful headlining tour to date, Lynyrd Skynyrd's chartered Convair CV-300 ran out of fuel near the end of their flight from Greenville, South Carolina, where they had just performed at the Greenville Memorial Auditorium to LSU in Baton Rouge, Louisiana. While the pilots tried to make an emergency landing, the airplane crashed, killing both pilot, co-pilot, Ronnie Van Zant, Steve Gaines, Cassie Gaines, assistant road manager Dean Kirkpatrick, while the other band members, Collins, Rosington, Wilkinson, Powell, Pyle, and Hawkins, and tour manager Ron Ekman were seriously injured. This was quite a tragedy, and it kind of rocked the music world. But when I went looking for conspiracies, this one kind of popped up that people are questioning why an airplane would run out of fuel. Thought it was kind of fishy, so I did look it up. And actually, one of the number one causes of airplane crashes is running out of fuel in flight. And talking to a pilot, while he didn't really give me a really straight answer, I think one of the problems they're dealing with is fuel consumption is kind of estimated because it's a variable of things like airspeed, headwinds, altitude, that type of thing, plus with how much load you're carrying and all that kind of stuff will dictate how much fuel you're going to be using on the airplane. And apparently if you're kind of on the edge, one of these oversights that could bite you kind of hard. So really there's nothing out of the ordinary of an airplane crashing. It's just, we're talking a tragedy here, not a conspiracy. And there seems to be a couple like that. But one of the interesting, when we start getting into some of the conspiracies, I came across the site. It looks like Georgia Tech has a conspiracy wiki. And I kind of went through there and had a pretty interesting go through. But basically, this particular article, it starts off with a little bit of history on rock and roll. And for those who, may not be aware, rock and roll was a genre of popular music that originated and evolved in the United States during the late 1940s and early 50s, primarily from a combination of blues, country music, and gospel music. Though elements of rock and roll could be heard in country records of the 30s and the blues records of the 20s, rock and roll didn't acquire its name until the 1950s. This was, now the origin of the term is generally attributed to Cleveland, Ohio disc jockey Alan Freed, who began playing this music in 1951. And again, I think some of the origins in those early days, and I think in general, any music that's popular amongst young people tends to be frowned upon by the older generations who are used to a different type of music. And generally in the southern Bible Belt, highly Christian areas of the United States had viewed rock and roll as kind of, I think they often refer to it as the devil's music, probably because it's a, in many cases, was taking Negro blues songs, various African-American origins, and of course, kind of making it more palatable for white people to enjoy. Guys like Jerry Lee Lewis had reworked a lot of the black jazz musics, and of course the Christian backlash to that. So a lot of the conspiracies kind of or like in the early period of the rock and roll has been probably more attributed to more religious backlash. But during the 50s, rock and roll was more controversial than conspiratorial. Elvis Presley with his gyrating hips, Little Richard, had all been kind of attacked for subverting white people. You had Jerry Lee Lewis, who had run into a little trouble in England over his Jerry Lee Lewis and his marriage to a 13-year-old first cousin once removed. Again, these were all controversial and kind of it didn't set well with the conservative parents of the time. It wouldn't be until the late 60s when the idea of conspiracies had begun to arise. And it apparently starts with the Monterey Pop Festival in 1967, where a number of rock legends had played. Brian Jones, a member of the Rolling Stones, Jimi Hendrix, Jim Morrison, I believe Janis Joplin, and oddly enough, many of these Otis Redding was there, and many of these had died under varying circumstances. In general, they were usually drug related or drug inspired, I guess, maybe more of a good term for it. And I'll get into that a little bit. But it also led to the 27 Club, which was, these rock legends had died at the age of 27. Kind of along the same lines as the curse of Saturday Night Live, where John Belushi, Gilda Radner, all these, coincidental, those who had been within that show had died for various reasons. Kind of drill in here a little bit. We'll start with, Jimi Hendrix, who had died in 1970. Jimi Hendrix had died on September 18th, 1970, slightly a year following his legendary performance at the Woodstock Music Festival, and the circumstances surrounding his death is still speculated upon. After a couple of days missing, Hendrix was found dead at the flat of his girlfriend, Monica Daneman. Autopsies revealed the large quantities of red wine in his stomach along with his lungs. The official cause of death was recorded as inhalation of vomit and barbiturate intoxication. Now, this is the official story. There has been couple claims here, like on the morning of his death, girlfriend Daneman claims to have woke up to find Hendrix sleeping normally and proceeded to go out for cigarettes. Upon returning, her story states that she found Hendrix had gotten sick and was having trouble breathing. She called Eric Burton of the Animals, who they had partied with the night before. He demanded that she call an ambulance. Daneman claims that the ambulance arrived around 11:30 a.m. and she rode with Hendricks on the way to the hospital where he suffocated en route. The recollection of the ambulance attendants are in direct contradiction of Daneman's story and claim that the apartment was empty except for Hendricks lying dead on the bed. After an unsuccessful attempt at revival, they pronounced him dead. Autopsy failed to conclude the time of death, but it was evident that Hendricks had been dead for some time before the paramedics arrived. And Eric Burton had chimed in, and he believes that Hendricks' death was a suicide. But again, facts contradicted this notion. Despite Hendricks' increasingly erratic behavior and dark circumstances present in his life, close friends claim that he was relatively happy at the time. Hendricks was found with 9 Vesperax sleeping pills in his system, which were said to contribute to his death. He was a chronic insomniac who was resistant to the effects of barbiturates and would not have felt such a disastrous effects from 9 pills. He was also found with a pack of 42 Vesperax in his pocket, which would rule out suicide. If Hendricks was intent on self-termination, it's assumed that he would have taken all the Vesperax. So, and of course, the conspiracy gets even uglier. Apparently, there's a supposedly, again, going back to the Monterey Pop Festival, there's some that believe that those who were present in the Monterey Pop Festival was kind of a peace rally, more than likely protesting the Vietnam War. And for some strange reason, the U.S. government wanted to kill all these people that were performing there. And again, the CIA, FBI, everybody's been involved. Some say that the Illuminati had it done. Of course, there's some, I'll get into some contradictions even there. So then, I want to go in next. The next person is Jim Morrison, who was the leader of the Doors. Jim Morrison's death in Paris, France, is one of the most widely speculated deaths in rock history. Several theories around his death. One, the most well-known, is that Jim Morrison staged his own death in order to lead some semblance of a normal life. Others include that the Doors frontman inhaled a substance that he thought was cocaine, but instead was heroin, and he may have just simply choked on his own vomit. Again, what seems to have happened, again, it's kind of unclear. What apparently he was out late one night, came back, took a bath, died of a cardiac arrest. His girlfriend at the time found the body, but then about a year later, she had died of a drug overdose. So a whole lot kind of disappears in this thing, and this is more of a kind of a wishful thinking that Jim Morrison got tired of the day-to-day rock and roll grind, wanted to get out of the business, so to speak, and kind of disappear. But unfortunately, much of the evidence points to a heart attack kind of brought on by heavy drug use. And again, kind of a shame to we lose a voice like his. I was also a big fan of the Doors, so I wouldn't say they're a great band, but they were really, really up there. Now, so it's kind of, and then kind of an offshoot of all this, there's this, again, we had the 27 Club, again, rock stars who had, didn't make it past 27, and many of these are popular rock stars, yeah, like Brian Jones, who used to be with the Rolling Stones, Janis Joplin, all of them, not making it past 27. Even sometimes they'll add in Kurt Cobain, who committed suicide at the age of 27. But again, this is more of a you're dealing with the kind of the people who are living the rock and roll lifestyle, sex, drugs, and rock and roll, and they burn the candle at both ends, whether it be alcohol, pills, cocaine, heroin, whatever they were, LSD, things to keep them creative. That's always been a kind of the general explanation for how they're created. A lot of times they'll use the drugs as a creativity tool to unlock inner feelings and things like that. Guys like, Ray Charles. I mean, he had his drug issues. Even outside the rock and roll world, John Belushi, and pretty much most of the that early cast had been using cocaine just to meet the deadlines that had been placed to put the show together. And this is kind of a through various interviews and so on that I've come across. So to expire at 27 is not too far of a stretch. And even that, it's kind of a coincidence that these are top names in the industry expiring at that age. But then again, you know, we have others that have, I have this huge list of those who have died of various, drug related, causes. So, it just happens that, these just happened to be in, you know, when they were only in their late 20s. Now, what I've talked about up to this point has been kind of individuals and the, you know, who had, for one reason or another through, you know, the lifestyle they left or the lifestyles that they had lived, basically it caught up with them and caused their demise. So, trying to call them conspiracies, other than maybe the Hendrix and maybe the Morrison, the rest of them have been, you know, the rest of I've talked about have just people kind of, I don't know, running their course. But there's been other conspiracies proposed surrounding rock and roll. Now, I talked a little bit about the Southern Christians who had been pretty much opposed to rock music, mainly because I believe they... It emulated or condoned African-American music. But another conspiracy, and this involves, actually, it centers around the Beatles, the Paul McCartney conspiracy. But apparently, there's even a bigger one involving the Beatles and actually rock and roll in general. And it's being called the Aquarian conspiracy. Now, there's this guy, Dr. John Coleman. I haven't found much information on him. He seems to be, I'm not sure if he's a doctor. It's hard to say. When I look up his sites, it's Dr. John Coleman. And when I, outside of his sites, it's just John Coleman, who is a prolific, conspiracy writer. And he's penned this, Aquarian conspiracy, which, here's a blurb on it. The phenomenon of the Beatles is not a spontaneous rebellion of youth against old social system. Instead, it was a carefully crafted plot to introduce by a conspiratorial body, which could not be identified, a highly destructive and divisive element into a large population group targeted for change against its will. New words and new phrases prepared by Tavistock were introduced to America along with the Beatles, words like rock in relation to music sounds, teenager cool discovered, and pop music were a lexicon of disguised words signifying the acceptance of drugs and arrived with and accompanied the Beatles wherever they went to be discovered by teenagers. Incidentally, the word teenagers was never used until just before the Beatles arrived on the scene, courtesy of the Tavistock Institute for Human Relations. Apparently, rock and roll, according to this and, you know, further reading, that rock and roll was a mind control, system. I guess that's the best way to hook American youth on drugs and sex and other self-destructive behaviors, which would lead to, I guess, maybe ultimately suicide, killing it off before, and of course, killing off useless eaters. This is all, you know, there's a lot of that kind of talk in here. And with the idea of, kind of the Illuminati trying to kill off 90% of the world population. Okay. I'm going to hold off some comments on this until later because I got more. So. Because the kind of the final chapter or Next to the last chapter, I'd like to talk a little bit about the John Lennon assassination. Now, like I've said in the I Buried Paul episode, the Beatles were fairly controversial, and so was John Lennon. And after the Beatles broke up, and John Lennon had gone off on his own career along with Yoko Ono, began a combination of producing music and being a political activist here in the United States. Lennon had decided to leave England and live in New York. I haven't really found out the exact reasons why he came to the United States, but it's maybe because of the easier access to recording, perhaps better access to the music industry or Hollywood and all that kind of stuff. So Mark David Chapman, on December 8th, 1980, bought a copy of Catcher in the Rye from a New York bookstore, in which he wrote, "This is my statement," and signed it Holden Caulfield. And he spent the day at the entrance of the Dakota apartment building where Lennon and Yoko Ono had lived. Around 5 p.m., Lennon and Ono left the Dakota for a recording session at Recording Plant Studios. As they walked toward their limousine, Chapman shook hands with Lennon and asked for him to sign his copy of his album Double Fantasy. Photographer Paul Goresh took a photo of Lennon signing Chapman's album. Chapman reported that at that point, my big part won, and I wanted to go back to my hotel, but I couldn't. I waited until he came back. I knew where the ducks went in winter, and I needed to know this, a reference to Catcher in the Rye. Around 10:49 p.m., the Lennon limousine returned to the Dakota. Lennon and Ono got out, passed Chapman, and walked toward the archway entrance of the building. From the street behind them, Chapman fired 5 shots from a .38 special revolver, 4 of which hit Lennon in the back and left shoulder. Their death certificate gives the following description: multiple gunshot wounds of the left shoulder and chest, left lung, and left subclavian artery, external and internal hemorrhaging, or internal and external hemorrhage, shock. At the time, one newspaper reported that before firing, Chapman softly called out Mr. Lennon and dropped into a crouched position. Chapman says he doesn't recall saying anything and that Lennon did not turn around. Chapman remained at the scene reading Catcher in the Rye until the police arrived. The New York City Police Department officers who first responded recognized that Lennon's wounds were severe, decided to transport him to Roosevelt Hospital. Chapman was arrested without incident. In his statement to police 3 hours later, Chapman said, "I am sure the big part of me is Holden Caulfield, who is the main person in the book. The small part of me must be the devil." Lennon was pronounced dead at 11:15 p.m. at St. Luke's Roosevelt Hospital Center. Now, one of the interesting aspects of this has been a kind of a coincidence that which involves the book Catcher in the Rye. Now, this particular book has been fairly controversial for many reasons. It has been banned in the United States on occasion. In 1960, a teacher in Tulsa, Oklahoma, was fired for assigning the novel in class. He was later reinstated. And between 1961 and 1982, The Catcher in the Rye was the most censored book in high schools and libraries in the United States. But apparently, the book has been associated with, there have been several shootings have been associated with the book, including Robert John Bardo's shooting of Rebecca Schaffler and John Hinckley Jr. assassination attempt of Ronald Reagan. Following the Mark David Chapman shooting of John Lennon, Chapman was arrested with his worn personal copy of the book, inside which he had written to Holden Caulfield from Holden Caulfield, "This is my statement." Actually, this is from, I'm reading this right from Wikipedia, and apparently he bought a new copy before the shooting, so there's some issues with this and Wikipedia. But anyhow, there's been a kind of a generalized conspiracy surrounding Catcher in the Rye, and it's supposed to be a part of they use this idea that some of the parts of this book has been part of a mind control. Like somehow they use it as a trigger to set the sleeper agents into operation. Again, it's kind of linked to the MK Ultra Conantelpro operation. I'm not too clear on the exactly what this is really about. I'm going to look into it more. Maybe I can come up with a show on just Catcher in the Rye. But certainly that book seems to be the kind of the probably has been more of a trigger to the conspiracy theorists to think that the CIA or the FBI or someone in the government wanting Lenin dead and somehow planted in Chapman's head that he's to kill Lenin. What was kind of interesting, when I was looking up Chapman, he actually had a list of people he wanted to kill, which included Johnny Carson, Walter Cronkite, Elizabeth Taylor, George C. Scott, and Jacqueline Kennedy Onassis. But according to Chapman, John Lennon seemed to be the easiest to find. So Chapman was examined at Bellevue Hospital. Doctors concluded that while delusional, he was competent to stand trials. 9 psychiatrists and clinical psychologists were prepared to testify at his trial. 6 said he was psychotic, and 3 that his delusions fell short of the necessary criteria for psychosis. Lawyer Herbert Annenberg was assigned to represent Chapman, but amid threats of lynching, withdrew. Police feared that Lennon fans might storm the hospital, so they transferred Chapman to Rikers Island. So here we have a kind of a mentally, I'll be nice and say he's mentally unstable, somehow convinced that, somehow, and I actually haven't been found what convinced him to try to kill these people, but certainly the guy has issues. So, and this is kind of a common amongst a lot of the, like with the Hinckley shooting of Ronald Reagan, he did that to impress Jodie Foster. So trying to find a conspiracy in that, I mean, kind of in a reality sense, there's no sense to it. I mean, we definitely got people that are pretty much unstable. So to try to draw, so going through all these, I'm trying to draw a conclusion here. What we're really dealing with, and what seems to be a few common threads, at least as far as what really happened, because we're dealing with people who have, like with the those who earlier on talking about Jim Morrison, Hendrix, Janis Joplin, Kurt Cobain. We're dealing with people who really kind of lived life on the edge, I guess. Fairly creative, which is kind of an understatement, but in many cases, like with Hendrix and Jim Morrison, they didn't actually have the, especially with Hendrix, the United States didn't really embrace him. It was over in Europe where he was very popular. And I don't know if that had issues, if he had issues with that, he's American. Why doesn't America love me? Everyone else does. Jim Morrison, his creativity started flagging late in his career, which probably contributed heavily to his drug habit and probably an alcohol habit. And then with Janis Joplin had died of a heroin overdose, probably combined with the effects of alcohol. Brian Jones had, he had died in a swimming accident, but apparently he had alcohol in his system. So, I mean, basically the lifestyle of these people probably did them in more than any outside forces. And then when you start talking about John Lennon, now we're dealing with outside forces a little bit, where you've got basically a mental case who decided for some reason John Lennon had to be killed, and giving no other reason other than, I don't know if he was inspired by Catcher in the Rye. And then, of course, when you mix all that up with the possibility of, what I didn't really talk about it earlier on Lennon was that Lennon was under investigation from the FBI. Now, whether the CIA was involved with it, I highly doubt, but the FBI was really concerned about his anti-war movement and his anti-war activities. So would J. Edgar Hoover want him dead? Probably not. It probably wouldn't serve any purpose other than maybe to shut him up. But I doubt very much the FBI, they're looking through the Lenin files from the FBI. There's very little concern based on the reports. They're just concerned about what he was been saying. And at least in Lenin's case, they could have him deported. And actually, that was the tack they were taking. They were looking at trying to get him out of the country. So then when you start getting into, but then I guess the funny thing is then when you start reading about the Aquarian conspiracy, and this guy has got quite a bit, but it's really kind of a weird, I think if they try to mix the CIA's attempt to, get LSD and drugs into Los Angeles to, get people hooked on, for some reason, get the African American community hooked on drugs. Though I believe that was somewhat questionable whether the CIA was actually involved or possible, but doesn't seem too logical. But with those type of stories springing up, the idea of an Illuminati trying to kill everyone off or getting everyone hooked on drugs or at least trying to get people not thinking about the possibility of an Illuminati trying to take over the world. This Aquarian conspiracy probably kind of works, but then again, we're talking about a lot of people that have to be involved to make this guy work. So I'm going to leave this up to you guys to what you think about it. If you have any comments, if you want to hear more about or want me to clarify some stuff, let me know. This is your show. And hopefully I kind of laid everything out. If there's more you want to hear, just let me know.
I can no longer sit back and allow communist infiltration, communist indoctrination, communist subversion, and the international communist conspiracy to sap and impurify all of our precious bodily fluids.
And for some news, again, this is, I've been at this for a year. This is episode 26. About a year ago, by the time you hear this, I've been podcasting this show for a year, and it's been going pretty good. I do appreciate everyone listening. Certainly still got a good following. Looks like roughly about 1,500 listeners that download this each podcast. Kind of numbers a little bit down from early on, but it's still, people are listening, and I do appreciate that. So I'm hoping at least before the end of the year, I'm hoping to delve more into the more serious conspiracies. I've been kind of building a foundation of what a conspiracy is, what is a conspiracy theory, this is all about. And the idea is that, again, to help you understand, maybe be able to apply some critical thinking to when someone presents a conspiracy to you, and are we looking at a real or not real conspiracy? So now I'm kind of launched the JFK assassination. I'm hoping to, after this one, get into the what I'm going to call the Warren Commission period of the conspiracy, and hopefully, again, getting into some of the more hardcore conspiracies, 9/11. Maybe some of the Illuminati conspiracies, the Freemasonry, all that kind of stuff. And then a couple of side notes. I'm a co-host on the BitSpot Report. I'm hoping you take a listen to that if you're into atheism or what you're, that's my, the BitSpot. I try not to be too religious on this program. So for me to kind of stretch my atheist legs, I volunteered as a co-host over there. So I be sure to check that out at the BitSpot, the BitSpot Report. You can find it on iTunes, Stitcher, and so on. I've been a member of the Dumbass Media Network. Again, we got a few great guys over there. The Dumbass himself, Chris Weber, he does a atheist program. And everything's been going pretty strong over there, too. And then a side note, I'm trying to organize a little project. Now, this is for the history, history types, military history. Back in the day, I was heavily into wargaming, the old Avalon Hill games, some of the miniature wargaming. And I'm kind of thinking of resurrecting that hobby a little bit. And I've created a website called AmericanWarGamers.com. And I'm thinking I would love to be able to actually, in a sense, I don't know if you might not be familiar with this. This may be going way out of, out of your, or way out there for you. But I used to enjoy this magazine called Wargamers Digest. It was produced by Gene McCoy, and it was a really excellent wargaming magazine. It looked at the various aspects of board wargaming, whether it was the the old hexagon maps and paper chips, or the miniature type war games. And I'd like to try to maybe kind of resurrect some of that old stuff. I haven't really been into the wargaming, but I'm really into the history part of it. And the nice thing about Wargamers Digest was that it had a lot of real excellent details on various battles, over the various periods, ancients, Napoleonic, Civil War, World War II, some modern warfare. So if you're into writing, if you want to, if you're into war games, if you're into the old war games, if you have an interest in history and writing stories about a favorite battle, I'd like to have you, go over to that website, or even write to me at feedback@mikebowler.com. And I'd like to look for some writers who would like to contribute to that project. So if you're interested, write to feedback@mikebowler.com. I haven't set up the emails for that particular domain yet, but I can announce it in a future show. And that's kind of like, and again, it's one of a project I'm kind of thinking of trying to launch. And so again, I would like to thank everyone for listening. I'm hoping this is going to go for a good long time, and I do appreciate listening to me, putting up with me for about a year, for the past year, and hopefully you'll put up with me for another year. Thank you. Thank you for listening to A Skeptic's Guide to Conspiracy. You can find my show notes and links to research material at mikebowler.com. That's MikeBohler.com. Feel free to leave me feedback at feedback@mikebowler.com. If there's a conspiracy you're interested in or wish to contribute more information to this or previous topics, feel free to send that to research@mikebowler.com. A Skeptic's Guide to Conspiracy is a proud member of the Dumbass Media Network. Be sure to check out other great podcasts at dumbassmedia.info. Intro music is Unchained Zarina from danosongs.com. Thank you for listening, and we will see you next time. Thank you. Good night.